This is Trek FM.
Captain's log, stardate 8141.6. Starship Enterprise departing for SETI Alpha 5 to pick up the crew of USS Reliant. All is well. And yet I can't help wondering about the friend I leave behind. There are always possibilities, Spock said. And if Genesis is indeed life from death, I must return to this place again.
He's really not dead. As long as we remember him.
It's a far, far better thing I do than I have ever done before. A far better resting place I go to than I've ever known.
Is that a poem?
Mm. Something Spock was trying to tell me. My birthday.
You okay, Jim? How do you feel?
Young.
Welcome, everyone, to a special episode of The Ready Room. Today, we're going to dispense with the usual format, so there's going to be no news. There's no feature segment focused on an episode. But instead, I am joined by my good friend Larry Nemechek, who everyone out there knows, to talk about Leonard Nimoy, who we lost on Friday. Larry, thanks for taking some time to sit down and chat with me in the midst of everything that's going on around you right now.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks, Chris. This is, if ever there was a time to do a special, throw it together and sit down and kind of throw the format out the window and do it, this would be it.
Yep, and that is what we are doing. So we have been trying to put this together now for about a day. Things have been really busy for you, and I know just before we sat down to record this, you were just over with our friend Dave Rossi toasting Leonard Nimoy. How was the mood there?
Well, that was... strangely enough, good friends of me, and especially my wife, a couple, the man's mother just passed away, and okay. There was a funeral today that I was at. And so it's been quite the 2 or 3 days here for mortality, and I realized she was about a year younger than my mother, who was still with us and doing okay. But so it's been a time of reflection overall. But so we came home and we're settled down and catching up on our Blacklist queue on Netflix, and Dave Rossi texts me and says, "Hey, we're going to go to a little pub in Burbank and at 8 to toast to Leonard and can you make it?" And I said, Janet looked at me and said, "You have to go." And so I said, "Sure." And he says, "Well, tweet it out." let everybody." So I'm like, "Okay, if we have 50 people show up, that'll be interesting." It wasn't anywhere near that big a crowd. So and it was all people we knew, and one of my best friends, Lee, the guy that got me going to Comic-Con and built my website. Saw that, and he said, "I haven't seen you in 9 months. I figured I have to come over to drink to Leonard to see you." But no, it was great. Darren Doctorman. It was a very small group, but very heartfelt. And we were all just sitting around telling, "You can't see this, but I started to go." I would never do this regularly. For one thing, it's like a relic. But I
oh well,
yeah. I wore my second ever Trek T-shirt back in the days when if you wanted to get McCoy on a T-shirt, you had to get an iron-on to do it because. Yeah. Lincoln, which is now Roddenberry.com, and Federation Trading Post, and April Public. Anyway, the first two or three or four mail order places when I was in high school and college, you couldn't get a McCoy ready-made t-shirt. You had to get an iron-on. So this
interesting.
Is,
yeah, I remember those iron-ons right there. And if you're mm-hmm. listening and you hear the mic rustling around there, that's Larry standing up to show me the very vintage t-shirt that he's wearing right
well,
now.
Well, we cleaned up my dad's house about 5 years ago after he died, and I grabbed this in my... The first one I have was an iron-on, and the only way you could get McCoy then was it was like a three-shot from Patterns of Force. So it's like my first Star Trek t-shirt was Kirk, Spock, McCoy in their Nazi gear, which was kind of odd. So this one of Kirk and Spock with the moment from Journey to Babel,
yeah,
where he's trying to show him the salute, and he says, "That hurts worse than the collar." that was a little bit better, more fitting. But yeah, these were those were the days. That's why I'm such a McCoy militant and a Scotty militant. At the beginning, you couldn't get it. So anyway, I'd never wear this. I got it out of the closet. Plus, I can wear it now. Only been the last two or three years I could wear this again from high school. So yeah, we just kind of threw our hair down and we sat around and told old Trek stories, and we were remembering when we all first met around the lot and after we moved out to L.A. And so yeah, it was really reflective. And I guess that's what we're going to get into here is, Leonard as a person and an actor, and then also the ripples out from that, Star Trek in general, and some of the cast that we've also already lost.
Yeah.
And those that are still with us, and what it's meant for so many people over so many years.
Well, that's what I was just telling my wife last night was that, you know, now Leonard passes away and, you know, we lost James Doohan, we lost DeForest Kelly, now we lost Leonard Nimoy. And someone tweeted out earlier today, I saw an image.
Of course, Majel. Technically, in a way,
yes,
Gene,
and of course,
in
Major,
91,
yes,
way back.
Gene,
yeah. I say way, way back, but yeah.
Sure. Someone tweeted out a picture of a scene from TOS where you've got Spock, Kirk, and Bones sitting around the conference table.
And Scotty,
yes.
If it's the one I saw, yes.
Yeah, that's right. The four of them. And then below it, a picture of just Kirk. And it just said, this makes me sad.
Sitting at the table with empty chairs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe been Dave Rossi who tweeted that, or he retweeted it, maybe.
I've seen that retweeted a lot.
But right. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of how I felt, and that's what I was telling my wife yesterday, that we're losing the cast of the original series now. And you mentioned you guys remembering when you moved out to L.A., and, you know, for you, growing up watching TOS, what did Leonard Nimoy and Spock mean to you when you were growing up and watching that?
Well, I've been very busy. I was saying on the other side of the room, for those playing a drinking game or whatever, the Ready Room drinking game.
The Ready Room drinking game, yeah.
Yeah. I was talking, when all this first broke, I was at a workshop on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. In fact, it's a workshop that's going to have a lot to do with my Trekland brand mm-hmm. in the coming year. So it was a little ironic then, and I took some karma out of that. But I had just walked in and was sitting down, and my friend Lee that came out tonight, I saw, and we had all turned our phones off for the workshop. That was a joke. You know, like, no tweeting, no texting. Everybody pay attention. Try to get yourselves out of that. But I guess I had my text on, and he texted me and said, "I'm really sorry to hear about Leonard Nimoy," or "I'm sad to hear about Leonard Nimoy." And I'm like, what, he had to go back to the hospital for his COPD? And then I suddenly went, he wouldn't tweet me out of the blue about a news story that he had to go back to the, you know. So I jumped up, went outside, and saw all the news. And, of course, it's like you have ripples, you have waves. You see the news, you have your own visceral reaction, you know, sadness. I think we all have a moment of looking at our own mortality.
Yeah.
And then it washes over you that, oh my God, this is another one. And what you flash over what Spock and Star Trek meant to you, and that's different for every person, and depending on where you came in, especially for the veteran, I don't say old fans, but the veteran fans that have been around since the beginning.
Yeah.
And then you start thinking about Dee and Jimmy and, you know, even Gene and Majel, and you start feeling very mortal, and you start thinking about the franchise as a whole, and if you're really sitting around pontificating like I started doing, you start thinking about pop culture in general and what Star Trek meant to pop culture. And, you know, I thought all those things too. And then a secondary wave was social media and how the world was melting down about this. Not melting down, but how half of internet, I swear, was about Leonard Nimoy on Friday and still into Saturday. And at one point I said, well, thank God we didn't have – Twitter and Facebook in 1999 or I wouldn't have made it, because you asked me about Spock and I, and I was very fond of Spock and Nimoy, and this has made me think about, I'd never say Spock was not one of my favorites, which sounds, I don't mean that he's not a favorite, but like I was kidding about my t-shirt. In the beginning, everything was Kirk, Spock, and the Enterprise, Kirk, Spock, and the Enterprise. And if you wanted to see a secondary character, even McCoy or Scotty, you know, the products weren't there in the very beginning. But this whole thing has made me realize, of course, you appreciate Spock and what Leonard Nimoy brought to the role. And a lot of things I just intellectually know, I started to process at an emotional level and think what an incredible actor he was. What a risk it was to jump into that role in his own trepidations. And I'm sorry, I'm rambling here bigger than I ever do.
No, well, this is a great time for us all to ramble.
I flash back to when we did the first Star Trek Continues episode, and Michael Forrest was reprising his Apollo role only as a man in his 80s. And he was talking about he and Leonard were in a play together. Oh, in a movie, I think, a small movie, shooting in New York. And he was talking about when Leonard flew to L.A. to read and test for the Spock role, and how he had to leave for a couple of days and come back. And when he came back, they were talking about it. And Leonard was saying, oh, my God, it's this science fiction show, and they want me to wear these ears. And he's saying, well, are you going to do it if they want you? And he's like, well, I guess I would. But it was just, you know, it's like there was a time before, you know, like they say, but when, you know, I knew Leonard Nimoy before he was Leonard Nimoy, you know, one of those moments. But I just start thinking about all those things, a lot of stories that are out there, things that are out in all kinds of, you know, people's recollections or Leonard's own writings. And he wrote a lot. And you start adding up those little stories and things like, you know, the neck pinch, the Vulcan neck pinch was invented when the script just said Spock knocks. I think it was Dagger of the Mind. I think. Spock knocks him out with a karate, you know, the villain or whatever his adversary out with a karate chop. And Leonard says, I think Spock would have a more, you know, a cooler, a more intellectual,
exactly,
a more science fiction-y way of doing it. But that's what, but Leonard did that on the thing. Leonard came up with the, you know, he stole the old old Jewish priest's, you know, split-fingered blessing gesture for the Vulcan greeting. It's iconic now for in Amok time. So how much he brought to that, and how much he brought quality as an actor in a role that could have been cardboardy and a caricature and ridiculed. And instead, and this is one thing I did not get to say, Sky TV called me, and I was on at midnight for the UK and Germany. But one thing, one of the many things I didn't get into that little five-minute bit was Leonard is the only actor of any of the Star Trek series to have ever been nominated for a Best Actor Emmy. And he was each year, all 3 years, even the third season, all 3 years of the original series, he was didn't win, but he was nominated for an acting Emmy for Star Trek. And he had another Emmy nomination later, too. But, okay, I'm going to take a breath here. I mean, those are that, but that's like the flood of things that went through.
That's how we feel,
you know,
right?
But then I was flashing back to when Dee died and all of that, and how that really, and I one of the things I tweeted was something about how Dee died was like a punch in the gut. And part of that was because, you know, Gene had died, but of the cast, Dee was the first one to go, and he was the first, plus he was my favorite character, the actor that I always knew even as a kid, that if there was any of them I would want to go have dinner with first, it would be him, or that I had a chance of having dinner with as a fan, it would be Dee. And that was like a sock to the gut, and with Leonard, it was sad, but I just felt like, I felt the universe shift. You know, I just felt like a paradigm shift. And anyway, so that's all. That was what was all processing through my head. And
can you imagine if he had gone out, auditioned for Star Trek, decided not to take the role? Do you think Star Trek would have become iconic in the franchise that it is now? Because I think, I mean, William Shatner and Captain Kirk is what people think of perhaps first, because he was the captain, but Spock is perhaps an even better known character. But I think Spock so much, and thanks to Leonard Nimoy's approach to the character, really embodies the message that Gene Roddenberry wanted to get out through Star Trek. And as I said when I recorded my Hyper Channel right after the news came out, I feel that Leonard Nimoy really tried and did so all the way to the end to uphold the ideals of Gene Roddenberry mm-hmm. and to guard the franchise and make sure that what he did really furthered that goal.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we can look at this on so many levels. One of them being that Leonard Nimoy is the only actor to have been with the series all the way, you know, from the beginning, from the cage. Mm-hmm. Spock was part of that, even when he was going to be half Martian. But that, you know, on one hand, Spock was the alien role, and even on a tiny budget, when everyone else is very, very white and very male, whether it was the network squashing that, you know, you can't be 50-50 male-female. It'll look like there's a lot of fooling around going on up there, you know, or even what Gene was pushing for on racial casting, which he was, by the time they went to series, he was being supported on that by NBC because the 60s were winding on and NBC was trying to push diversity in the casting. But when you think about Nimoy being around from the beginning and you think of everything from the whole pointed ears looking satanic and, you know, the famous sales brochure where his ears were airbrushed and then yeah. no one later on would admit to that. And I always heard that story. And then Bob Justman and Herb Solo stuck the book in their book, the booklet in their book. So you can actually see the photo to the story. I just came across a couple years ago where Leonard had like 11th hour jitters about playing Spock and went in and was talking to Gene about, well, if this, you know, doesn't work out, can we do something with the ears or have him clip them later on? It reminded me a little bit about LeVar Burton being jittery about having to wear the visor constantly and saying, yeah. well, I'm an actor and it takes away my eyes. And can we maybe talk about maybe finding a way to replace the visor partway through the show? And they said, okay. And then a year or two in, he's like, no, this means too much to people. You know, to do that, and Leonard doing that too, realizing that six months after they did that, that it was silly to worry about the ears and all that. But mm-hmm. that reaction. But yeah, so in a '60s world where the big thing was having an Asian and a Russian and a black woman, that those ears were about the only way until they blew the budget on some Andorians or Tellarites or something or an Orion girl. That was the only way you were remembering you were in space. So. When you think about the format of the show as a show, it was, you know, the 60s, lead character, second banana, a bunch of little people at first. And we always talk, or I do anyway, talk about D. Kelly doing so much with McCoy and the on-screen chemistry, you know, forcing the writers to use him and Jimmy and Deschelle and all the other characters in more and more ways, although they always just got recurring billing and they were always at the bottom,
yeah,
the you know, back end. But how, you know, D got into the above-the-line credits at the beginning of the show. But the other thing about how Spock took off, Nimoy brought so much to Spock out of the box once he got it with Naked Time and the split character and what being half-human meant, and how it almost became a problem because Spock became so popular that right, it made Shatner uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And his mail was outrunning Shatner's, and his agent was wanting more money, and how they almost dropped him at the end of the first season, and they had the three lists, you know, that are now that's out there about how they had the, including Martin Landau and including Mark Lennard and including Lawrence Montaigne, and everybody they'd all almost had ever considered for any Vulcan or Romulan role, which, you know, went away. But that tension in the beginning was not supposed to have happened. And Spock was so popular, it was such a boon for the show, but it was almost a curse for everybody who had to deal with, you know, insecure actors at the time having the first big success of their lives on a show that technically wasn't a success, but it was and got a lot of attention. And then how they resolved it, and then how they came up with that equal favored status clause. And from then to this day, they've both gotten the exact, you know, percentage of all Star Trek. And Leonard directed a couple of movies, and Shatner came in to do it. And, you know, how they've been such best buddies since, and how that all started off because of the success that Leonard brought to a role that in the Cage script especially was just the, you know, number two, number three, number four role.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Well, it's reminds me of Michael Dorn and Worf and what Michael mm-hmm. Dorn brought to the role. And then they saw that that's popular. And then he went on to also, like Leonard Nimoy, be one of the longest running characters in Star Trek. But as you said, with Leonard Nimoy, he was there in The Cage and he was there in Into Darkness. So he was there literally for the entire mm-hmm. run to date of Star Trek.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, but it obviously was. Yeah. Damn it, Chris, I thought I was done processing all these little aha moments. You throw another one at me.
There's always another one.
It's an obvious one, but my brain hadn't gotten around to that one yet. There's so many ripples to and things that you don't think about until they're past. And yet, I was reading today where somebody was making fun of, and I'm taking this on second credit, but voice here, but I saw someone making fun of, I guess when it was breaking news on CNN, the anchor at the time broke in and said, well, here's the kind of sad news we hate to have to report, but Leonard Nimoy, who made the character Dr. Spock so famous.
Did someone really say that?
Yes.
Oh, goodness.
And there was a whole thread talking about that, and I've been thinking, wow, that's such a throwback. That's such a 60s, 70s thing.
Yeah.
I thought everybody was beyond that. I mean, Dr. Benjamin Spock isn't even, famous in the news every day, in the nightly, monologues of late night comedians like it was in the 60s and 70s. It's like, how'd they do that?
His pointed ears, which were the result of an unfortunate incident with a Chinese rice picker.
Yes.
So,
which very few people know these days.
That's right. So why do you think Spock connects so well with fans? Because for me, like when I read a lot of the coverage of him passing, people always start out with, he inspired generations to pursue careers in science. And I think that's probably true. But for me, it was always more about his cool demeanor and
being unflappable in a crisis,
approaching problems that you face in life of, trying to find a solution and not panic about something. But I guess for different fans, it's different things. When you've talked to fans, what do you find to be the connection they have with Spock?
That's one thing. It's like so many aspects of Star Trek, people take away, different takeaways.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the big ones, it's kind of the way Vulcans evolved. Leonard had a lot to do with this. Dorothy Fontana, Gene Kuhn, all the early, Bob Justman, all the early molders and shapers of Star Trek with Leonard at the pinnacle of this. But the whole thing about Vulcans being, unemotional, evolving into, although people debate this now, the 7-year mating cycle. Mm-hmm. How are you, as we saw with Spock and T'Pring and Staan, and then later on with Sarek and his human wife, how do you have an emotionless species? How do they reproduce? How do they have mates? Much less, religion and how do they deal with their offspring? Is there any warmth at all? And we kind of got to the point where, as even though Leonard's Spock's point was that he was half human, so the human half of him was the one that was always in turmoil, like with Leilani and this side of paradise or whatever. But the fact that even for the full blood Vulcans, which really I guess were championed by Sarek as far as screen time there for a while. How it's not that they're emotionless, but, because of their history and they suppress the emotions because they're about to tear themselves apart. They were so passionate. They were so strong. They still had the, and everything, so much of their life, like Ponfar, is a biological reaction to the emotional suppression of emotions all the rest of the time. So as all that was kind of just barely being laid in and then evolved through all the fan fiction, much less the movies and then all the subsequent shows and... But that's one thing. I mean, that was a huge allure to why I've been running around the last 4 or 5 years and saying, well, this geek girl revolution is wonderful. But kiddos, if you go back and look at the explosion of Star Trek fandom that had never happened before for a TV show, Rock Band, Singer, sure, but a television show, for people to demand that it be canceled, Star Trek was the first show where they actually finally said uncle and came on. Right? They came on during the final credits and said, relax, relax, Star Trek will be back next fall. That had never happened again. They're not even used to people watching TV being savvy enough to know how the TV industry worked in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And then for that fandom whose whole purpose, their whole Star Trek fandom beginning, the whole point it existed was to have Star Trek come back. They were celebrating the show and indulging their passions. But the whole point of Star Trek fandom was to have a new TV show or a movie or something, have it brought back from the dead, like fandom triumphs. That's why Star Trek fans are the ownership of the show, even though they're all sitting in front of their living rooms and TV screens and movie screens, not working in the industry on the show. But people owned it because they say, we brought it back. If it hadn't been for us, Star Trek would have been dead. And, later on, Paramount and CBS, you wouldn't have made your millions and billions if it hadn't been for us demanding this. And... you look at all that activity, the conventions, especially the fanzines and the fan literature, you know, the fan lit, all the things that got invented because they didn't exist, and in a time before computers and internet and social media, the Star Trek Well Committee, which was invented to answer fan questions and link them up, and everything being done by snail mail and a SACI, you know, a stamp self-addressed envelope.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, conventions, fanzines, and that was 60, 70, 80% driven by women. You know, Bijo and Helen Young at the Well Committee, and then Shirley Mayuski, and I'm going to get in trouble for not mentioning some of these names, and some of them have just been passing here lately, but... we tried to start getting those people interviewed on Communicator when we still had Communicator and I was editor. But this whole thing about the Geek Girl Revolution being a recent thing, women were doing all the pushing and inventing and creating because of, my point finally, that Vulcan allure, that stoicism of Spock, watching shows like Leilani and even Droxine and the Romulan Commander, and kind of that, just that sexual attraction that he brought to it. And if you really wanted to get playful, that whole thing of like, oh yeah, you, well, I could turn him. You know,
I can make him feel emotion.
I can make him feel emotion. I'll make him, I'll, 7 years, ha, he won't want to wait 7 years with me. And I don't want to get crass about it, but there was a huge sexual turn-on attraction to Spock.
Well, I still see that today with female fans. I mean, all you need to do is go on Twitter and talk to fans, and you see that that's still the case now. And not Zachary Quinto Spock, but Leonard Nimoy Spock.
Yeah. So that was a boon for the show and boon for, I mean, that was one thing. So, but yes, what you said, all the doctors and engineers and scientists who have told Dee and Jimmy and Leonard over the years, and then on beyond that, each succeeding cast even. But it was that 30 years of those guys being, you know, no bloody A, B, C, or D.
Yeah.
It was 20 years or whatever of just them alone. Inspiring. I mean, so Friday, as this all is exploding and blowing up and unfolding across the internet and across the world, and people are hearing, you know, my Twitter is blowing up. I'm at this conference, this workshop, which is an incredibly great conference, and I couldn't like just respond, and I wasn't at home where I had all my library and my materials and archives here. But Twitter's blowing up and Facebook's blowing up, and then people I've known for a long time are just emailing me. And saying, Larry, did you hear? So my friend Mitzi Adams, who is a NASA solar scientist and works at a NASA installation, I'll say.
Back in my home state.
Yes. Okay, well, we'll say that. Yes, Alabama. I just, you know, about 3:15 in the afternoon Pacific, she just wrote me an email and said, today we lost a great human being. He touched so many people. It's partly because of him that I'm a scientist, and totally because of him that I lost my southern accent, most of it anyway, which may or may not be a good thing. When I was in 6th and 7th grade, I not only wanted to sound like Spock, I wanted to be Spock.
That's interesting.
Barring that, I wanted Scotty to beam me up so I could be his assistant. Math and science were my tickets to be part of the Enterprise crew, and as I got older, I began to appreciate the arts as well and to understand why Leonard Nimoy supported them. I wish we could have seen, heard more of him in the last few years, but I know he's not been well, and I hope he did not suffer. R.I.P. Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah.
But, you know, we the people that I've known for ages and years, and maybe we even, like, blip back and forth on Facebook or when something comes up, it's just one of those moments when everybody felt that need to share. And it's, I almost feel like, again, which got me back to when Gene died, what was the reaction, and what was the community, and how big was it, and how did mainstream media look, and how did your, if you were a fan and you had friends and family that weren't, how did they react? I mean, my brain was just exploding with, you know, the ripples out from Leonard. Anyway, I've said this already. And when Dee died, and it's almost been like a milepost marker or a touchstone to realize what the reaction has been and how much of the world has been. And hey, yeah, we're in the Big Bang Theory, the geeks won, the geek war kind of a thing. And comparing the reaction here to the losses of Jimmy in 2005, even, which wasn't that long ago,
mm-hmm.
and Majel in 2008, late 2008. And there was a lot of outpouring. Of course, not to put a billboard to it or a credit, Leonard was either number two or equal co-favorite nation there as far. But just Spock in those ears and being an icon of, and like I said today, when Star Trek finally kind of, the mainstream let Star Trek in 86, when Star Trek IV and the Whales movie, which he directed, was such a hit, when they had the 20th anniversary, the first one that the studio kind of got behind as a big deal, and they announced Next Generation was coming, and all that coalesced. So Star Trek was finally mainstream. What did Newsweek do? Who'd they put on the cover for their cover story? They put Spock. They put Leonard Spock on the cover. Not the Enterprise flying, not Kirk, not a group cast. They just had one big bang image, and I've had that off and on using it. It's on my Twitter today, but you know, and it just says the whole title was a big thing of Spock, and the caption was "The Enduring Power of Star Trek."
Yeah,
and that's when I really think about all that. That's why I talk about 1986 to me being such a huge year for everything on so many levels. But that's another part of it.
Yeah, I feel like Spock is the character internationally that everyone knows, and I feel like when thinking about social media, so when James Doohan died, we didn't really have social media in the way we do now. Certainly not the way we do now, but when Majel died, maybe it was there a bit. But even so, I still got sort of the outpouring similar for James Doohan, for DeForest Kelly. But with Spock, it seems even bigger. With Leonard Nimoy, it seems even bigger. And I think part of that, too, is this international appeal and connection that for most, there is the Enterprise, yes, but Spock, the Vulcan character, represents Star Trek. And I think that's largely thanks to Leonard Nimoy, because he created the Vulcan character. Here's something I want to ask you about. When I think of Spock, I go all the way from the cage and the early episodes where we call him Spock Bob Shouty Pants, where he's yelling at the screen on the bridge.
The women!
But then go all the way to...
Check the circuit.
Exactly. And then go all the way to The Undiscovered Country. And I actually played the clip in Hyper Channel this weekend of his conversation with Valeris, where he says that he keeps the painting in his quarters of the expulsion from paradise because it reminds him that all things end. But with the way that Leonard Nimoy delivers those lines, I also think about him as an actor and his role within Star Trek and coming to terms with that, because of course he wrote the book I Am Not Spock.
Right.
Then he wrote the book I Am Spock.
Right.
And I think, as is the case often with anyone who is involved in something that becomes so big, you kind of have a struggle with your own identity versus how people associate you with that. But where I'm going here with the scene with Valeris is that I always felt, from the moment I saw it in the theater, that Leonard Nimoy was speaking there even more so than the character of Spock, that there's a certain resolution of the character and what he says about logic where he himself has come to terms with his role within this franchise, you know, Star Trek over the years,
right?
A maturity to the character and a maturity to his own feeling of association with this. Do you feel that as well?
Yeah, I get that. I hadn't thought about that way, but no, totally. And you see that it's almost like some people would say it's a lovely curse to have, but when you are an instant hit and you're an actor, I think people are savvy about it now. In the old days, you know, you had the wall between TV and movie, and we didn't have social media, and people could be personalities and hide back, or they had publicists making up stories to put in fan, you know, old ways and rigid ways and things. And there's so much we have paparazzi running around, we have TMZ, we have 24/7 cable channels and social media, blah, 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 drowning us in so much stuff that it's hard to have, if you want to have any privacy at all, then now you're the snoot that won't share anything with the world.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, the atmosphere is so different. And I think it may be less of a problem now. I think people are just happy to be out doing anything. And you see people, movie stars, having fun coming on shows they have a connection to or appreciation of, and guest starring on a TV show, and it's no big deal. But that whole thing, the whole original series cast, were totally blindsided by Star Trek. You know, it's like, the good news is you're part of a worldwide phenomenon. The second thing is, you know, you've been stereotyped and you're not getting paid for being a worldwide cult god. Because from Gene on down, they were no residuals. They got paid for one rerun. That was it. And so until the motion picture, none of them got it, aside from their convention, whatever. And then they get to be like actors who are, and then they get to do the Galaxy Quest thing, you know, and be the washed up actors who can't get a job doing anything but going to conventions. And back then, conventions were held in way lower esteem than like Comic-Con now is. It's a pop cultural phenomenon, has all the respect in the world. But
yeah, conventions were not what people think of them as today.
And and he wrote, I'm Not Spock, and pissed a lot of people off. And then he says, I'm trying to separate it out. Even to the point where, remember, they were going to do phase two.
Yeah.
And he's the only part of the cast that would not agree to come back past the pilot. So they created Zahn to replace Spock and, you know, put a good spin on it. Oh, he'll be a full-blood Vulcan. Then we do the motion picture. He's aboard. Oh, it's a success enough. Now we're going to do the Wrath of Khan. Okay, I'm in it, but I really don't want to keep doing these movies the rest of my life. I have lots of other things to do, and which he did want to do, and he did. And then the Wrath of Khan turns out to be epic, and they shoot the ending so he can still be alive and all that. And, oh, and here's what'll sweeten the pot. I'll come back and direct three. So, right, so he's had that evolution of that comfort zone with this 600-pound monster in the room called Star Trek that's both a blessing and a curse. And everybody since then, although, you know, the Next Generation cast went in thinking, we can't possibly be as successful and popular as the original cast. This is going to last a year. They're doing the syndicated show. No one's going to pay enough for this to have it go. You know, and they were, I don't want to say they were blindsided as much as the original series cast was. They were at least on the same page. And they were pleasantly surprised, and it was fine. And all the cast since then came in going, oh boy, 7 years, yahoo,
exactly.
I can have a house and pay my car. But yeah, you can watch some of the things of his, you know, outward life. And he did, we should say too, originally, you know, wound up directing Three Men and a Baby, directed, what was it, The Good Mother? Was that the other one?
I think so.
Yeah, you know, acted against Ingrid Bergman for Harve Bennett in her last role. She had cancer and hadn't told anyone on the story of Golda Meir, a woman called Golda. Still did his theater, got into his Equus. That was a big thing in the 70s. He was huge on the revival of Equus, playing the psychologist. But, you know, and then he got into his photography, kind of shook the world up with his Jewish model nudes.
Mm-hmm.
Nude photography, and then branched out from there. And as the years went by, he got more comfortable in the skin of, I have much more in my life besides Spock, and now I can actually relax and enjoy Spock.
Yeah, I heard more about his photography when I lived in Reno, because he had some exhibitions there, and also up at the lake where my family lives at Lake Tahoe. Leonard had a house up there. So my aunt would sometimes see him coming in and out of the Albertsons down the road. And, you know, it's kind of like a local thing there. And he was doing the photography. But it's great that he could pursue those things later on and become fairly well known, maybe not to the broad general public, but to creative community and others for those things. And like you said, maybe then he could enjoy Spock. And when I think about the fact that he was willing to come around at the end with the Abrams verse and sign on to do that, at least that created some connection for fans to what had come before and maybe added some legitimacy to that. But also, as I said, again, when I recorded my thoughts on Hyperchannel, the fact that he agreed to do that, it certainly helped me, because I felt that if Leonard Nimoy has decided that this is worth doing, then there must be something to it, because he was certainly not someone who was just going to go do it to get a paycheck for doing that film or to cash in on the Star Trek brand. It was more like, I won't do it unless you prove to me that it upholds Star Trek and what we stand for.
Well, you know, the latter day, the stories that come out now, some of them were actually upset when they were, Is There in Truth No Beauty? Third season, mm-hmm. and Gene was a little bit removed from the show by then. You know, Fred Freiberger was running it by Gene's own hand, and it was a complicated year, and, you know, they were going to wind up being canceled, and the budget cuts, and Gene still fighting NBC, and all those things going on, and Gene looking out down the line, and one of the most hallowed, you know, one of the most beloved parts of Star Trek, especially in the beginning, you know, the first generation of fandom, like we were talking before, you know, Klingons and Romulans and whatever, there weren't that many alien races that were really there. Again, Andorians and Tellarites, I was a militant Tellarite fan because they got getting left off of posters and artwork and things. But, you know, the number one fandom of an alien fandom was Vulcans.
Yeah.
You know, and I think Gene had, he knew how attractive the Vulcans were in conjuring up fandom of all kinds, especially the female fans. And by the third year, I think thinking the writing was on the wall for Star Trek maybe going down the tubes or being a big fight, writing the Idic, you know, infinite diversity, infinite combinations, which is a wonderful thing. Although I realized it's yet another thing where we're the alien. So that culture is using its Terran English acronym as their own.
Of course.
until we got a word for it in Voyager, I think. But the day when they were shooting the banquet scene for Is There in Truth No Beauty, and they ran in and they had designed the Idic pendant, you know, the triangle and the circle as a brooch, and they were all a little pissed off because the whole thing to them at the time smacked, oh, Gene's just going to make a bunch of these and sell them, and he's just thinking about hawking, you know, toys and things, which was a big part of the truth. But it still was true to Star Trek. It was still true to Vulcans. It was still what Gene, if it wasn't stated overtly, you know, infinite diversity and infinite combinations, celebrating how we're all one humanity or even one galaxy. And then that later, you know, became one of the most hallowed trademarks and hallowed catchphrases and an instant symbol of what Star Trek was all about, the Roddenberry vision, and embraced by everyone, including Spock. But I just, you know, I don't know why I brought that story up, but I think Leonard's first reaction was a little, you know, queasy about it. And he didn't always have the right line on things. I mean, he had some great choices. We were talking about, you know, the pinch and the salute and all that. But he got cold feet about doing it at all in the beginning, and he wasn't going to come back after Wrath of Khan and change his mind. So he's human. He's an actor. He's worried about his career, just like you look at almost anybody else in Star Trek or anything, and you can tell what, you know, the moods they're in as the pendulum of their life swings back and forth. They're human,
sure.
And thankfully, he was around long enough and got settled in that skin and had enough other successes to where he was able to embrace, just like he and Shatner started off a little bit with a little bit of friction, but wound up
having very
a comfort
close
zone there. Right. And then for the last 20, 30 years, people's, you know, fans would see him at conventions and Creation would always have them together at Vegas. And it was just, you know, you never knew what was going to happen. And those were just some golden moments.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, by the time you get to The Undiscovered Country, I feel like that's Spock in that film, Leonard Nimoy's portrayal of Spock, not only in the scene that I mentioned, but throughout the film. It's just one of someone being very at ease with that role and what it represents.
And then, what, 2 years later, should mention this too. You know, the idea of the passing the baton movie when the next gen people are going to do Generations. And Rick and Ron and Brannon wanted to write that preamble scene, prologue scene with everybody in it. And Leonard followed by Dee saying, we had our big send off. This just feels very tokeny. Like we're all just crammed in here in the beginning. And there was probably a little bit of ego to it, but I totally get what he's saying. That it's just kind of like coming out from one too many curtain calls.
Yeah. Oh, I agree completely. I was glad that they didn't do that scene. Having a few people there, having Kirk there, obviously, because so much of the movie revolves around him. Having Scotty there, having Chekhov there was fine. But I totally agree with what Leonard was saying, that they had such a perfect send-off at the end of The Undiscovered Country. There was no need to say anything else, because that was just the perfect ending.
Part of that negotiation was he asked about directing. Mm-hmm. And when they got that in that discussion, he was, you know, talking about, well, most directors, and I think the experience on the original series movies had been that too, you know, directors making changes. Certainly Nick Meyer did, and Leonard did too, tweaking things and making changes. And, you know, the TNG group going forward were pretty much on board with everything and saying, you know, in effect, well, the script's pretty much locked. and that kind of being a rebuff. So he wasn't interested in being a robot director, I guess.
Sure.
He wanted to be able to have some creative, you know. And then you flash forward the early years of Next Generation. You had, you know, you had Dee doing his McCoy send-off kind of blessing in the pilot. And then after that, you know, Next Generation will really be here. You know, are they ever going to, because of the way it was set up, which was genius. But, you know, I don't know about if we'll ever see Kirk in the Next Generation. McCoy's still alive and Spock is Vulcan and they live 200, 300 years. So what are we, you know, are going to see Spock? We're going to see Spock. And people would pitch stories and, you know, and then we saw Sarek and we've, you know, we've talked about that and all the hoopla. Sarek was part of Eric Stillwell's original pitch for yesterday's Enterprise, and they pulled the idea out and wound up doing the whole episode about Sarek, and I think we've talked about that. But
yeah, we have.
But all even the Spock issues around that, and Spock was such a... The character of Spock, as Next Generation was going, was such a hot potato, which is, again, a testament to the power, the convenience of Vulcans having long lifespans, but the power of Leonard Nimoy and that character. So that when Six was done, and the, you know, and Rick... The you know, Rick Berman was had TVs and about to do movies, had the bridge out to Harb Bennett. Well, Harb Bennett wasn't doing Six. It was Ralph Winter and Nick Meyer. But they had the kind of, you know, hands across the sea between the TV and movies moment of, okay, part of the deal will be with Paramount. Part, you know, Leonard will come over and do this two-parter, and Leonard will be, Spock will be on the Next Generation. It'll be the biggest entertainment news of the year. And it'll two-parter, and that's all part of the celebration of the anniversary then, which mm-hmm. was, what, 92? That was 25th. Yeah, the 25th yeah. anniversary shows. The whole tie-in was the movie send-off
yep.
on the big screen, and then mm-hmm. him and, you know, and part of his deal also was that his son Adam, who was an up-and-coming director, would direct a couple. I mean, it was, a big package there, and it was a lot to do. And then Michael Piller later on said he was disappointed in himself for how he didn't think Unification came off, the script came off as well as it could have. But still,
it was still a big moment. I mean, I remember when it aired
and moment.
Leading up to it and just, you know, waiting to see it. And it was fantastic.
And it was so huge that when the companion, Next Generation Companion came out, and I think I've told this story, but real quick, he was having an issue with licensing because no one at Paramount yelled at Post Cereals for having a Barney put on pointed ears in a Post Fruity Pebbles commercial. And he wasn't happy with that. And so for about 3 or 4 months, he was not approving his photo requests for licensing, which boiled down to me. And the first edition, the very first editions of the Next Gen Companion in the blue cover, the original one, had to roll with no Spock pictures in the Unification Part 2.
Oh, wow.
Which was like the whole point of, like, and we this came out at the end of the fifth season. So the high point, technically, of the entire series to the end of the fifth season, we talk about it, but that was another lesson where I learned that Hollywood is all about pictures, not words.
Yeah.
Even in books. But within a couple of months, that was resolved, and they very quickly started, you know, cranking out. We had the pictures pulled. We had the pictures ready, the photos.
I do not remember the Fruity Pebbles commercial with the pointed ears.
It wasn't overtly Vulcan-y, Spock-ish or anything. Maybe Barney kind of talks pseudo-intellectually.
Did he say something like, eat long and prosper?
I don't know if he said something about it being fascinating or, you know, whatever. But
this cereal is so crunchy, it's fascinating. Eat long and prosper.
Or if he says, Fred, it is illogical that you should have all the Fruity Pebbles or something. I don't know. It was kind of wacky, and they're like these like rubber ears with or like pointy ears with an obvious yeah. Like string around his head or something goofy.
Yeah. Interesting.
No wait, Goofy's dizzy. But
right, don't get us in trouble there, Larry.
But it's here again is the power of Spock, and the clout that Leonard Nimoy had, and And so iconic and powerful that when they started, Next Generation, the old mantra about no Klingons, Romulans, Vulcans, this show has to stand on its own. But they went so long, they wouldn't even have a Vulcan guest star in. They would have that Vulcan extra in the Farpoint pilot.
Like in Farpoint, there are a lot of Vulcans roaming around in the shadows, and that's it.
It was such a big deal to have the Vulcan What was it? Not the Vulcan girl. No, not the Vulcan. The girl mentioned she was from Vulcana Rajar.
Okay.
In Coming of Age.
Yeah.
And then you finally, what was it? We had the Vulcan captain, Savar, was in, about the time the show got comfortable enough to have Romulans. Conspiracy. One of the senior, it was like they finally got over the, but, you know, and then we had Dr. Salar, Susie Plaxton's character, and we finally got to dabble some Vulcans in by the end of the series. Like so many other things, they were back into their comfort zone and they were their own show.
Yeah.
But again, that's the power of Vulcans led by Leonard Nimoy, that they, you know, backed off. And then, and that when they designed DS9, they don't even think about having a Vulcan, still having a Vulcan. It wasn't until Voyager that they thought enough time had gone that if they did a Vulcan character, it would not be a copy, or it wouldn't be so much in the shadow, or it wouldn't be so influenced by Spock and by Leonard's portrayal. And of course, even then they said, said, you know, Tuvok's going to be a full-blood Vulcan. We've never had a full-blood Vulcan before. That'll be a whole different thing to, you know, they had to.
But it's all influenced by Leonard's portrayal. Certainly Tuvok is. And then when you get to T'Pol, I mean, Jolene even said that she was a fan of Spock growing up, and that influenced how she played her Vulcan character. So it all comes back around.
Well, and Kirstie Alley going in, you know, her first role is the Wrath of Khan. She's a kid running around. Her dad owns some lumber and hardware, you know, mega stores around in Wichita. She was in fandom, went to conventions. She practiced her Vulcan eyebrow lift and came out and blew them away when she was, you know, her first, not, I don't know if it was her first audition, but the first role.
Yeah.
And blew them away in the room. And she, that's why she, you know, did so well in The Wrath of Khan out of the blue. Because she was really like the first generation of Star Trek fan having an impact on future shows. Like we talk about the writers gradually infiltrating, and some of the later, you know, Tim Russ was a big fan. Michael Dorn was a fanboy. But Kirstie Alley was really, now that I stop and think about it, was maybe one of the first generation of Star Trek kids to grow up and come back and work in the franchise, you know.
Interesting point. And of course, played a Vulcan.
And of course, yeah, I played a Vulcan, very obviously, but, you know, either way, on or, you know, before or behind the camera. That sucks. Yeah. There were people that were fans that were working behind the scenes too, but I think on camera especially. But it just goes back to the power of Spock and what Leonard Nimoy brought to him.
Well, let me ask you, as we kind of start to wrap up our thoughts here, I've already shared with you and with everyone else through Hyperchannel that the scene that I come back to with Spock is the one I mentioned with Valeris in Star Trek VI. But, I mean, for you, whether it's TOS or whether it's the films, what is the key moment for Spock, or what are the key moments, if there's more than one, that really sum up the character, just most memorable for you over the years?
Well, you know, the naked time, which is a big turning point for him. It's when he talks about he finally got the character. Actually, he talks Enemy Within and talking to Kirk being split in half, and then it really brought it home. So much of my Star Trek thinking is skewed through a McCoy lens. I can think of, you know, like the Spock McCoy thing. Well, I mean, you know, Amok Time and Mirror Spock and Mirror Mirror. See, that's what I mean. I said this a little bit at the beginning, that I love that, you know, you go from just, you know, being taken over, consumed by the show, and I'm saying original series. I know we live in a world where there are, what, 747 hours of Star Trek that you can pick from, but I'm talking about when we only had 79 episodes.
Yeah.
But it happens with everybody on whatever level it is and whatever show. You're bitten by the bug. You're overwhelmed. If you've never seen Star Trek before, or you're watching a new one for the first time, you're overwhelmed. And then as you keep watching, you start sorting out, you know, exactly what it is that's attracting you, and you gravitate there a little bit. And that happened for me. And so over the years, it was very easy to say, well, I love everybody. I love seeing all the actors and characters. McCoy and then Scotty secondarily were, you know, great fans of mine. And kind of by extension, the actors. And I had the great fortune to finally get to talk to Dee a little bit, and then Jimmy a lot. And I've, you know, worked with George and Walter. And now we're going to have Nichelle in The Con of Wrath too. And, you know, you'd see them at conventions and go from being a fan to, you know, working with them is mostly as colleagues a little bit, but still for me, the original series people are still out there, the ones you enjoyed as a kid and got you into this, these flavors of this business, and next-gen people a little bit, although got to know them very quickly. And then the other series, just my personal viewpoint, was I was here when the show started and watched them came in. And, you know, and you're more contemporaneous in terms of age and all that. But this whole thing of Leonard's passing has made me go back and think about how, I don't want to say I underappreciated Spock, but just thinking about what Spock meant to people and to the world and to pop culture. And, you know, that Sheldon Cooper is this one of the most recognized characters in the world in that show. You know, you just stop and think about Spock and Leonard as a lightning rod for Star Trek and for genre entertainment, that Star Trek wrote the template for how, as a fandom, and how pop culture and how mainstream looks at all that, and how that's evolved and matured. And, you know, the almighty dollar has a great hand in making people respect something, but even beyond that, and how, and then how much of the world has grown up with the original series characters, we talked about that, and it influenced what jobs people did or how they approached life. One of our project managers on Enterprise in Space, Alice Hoffman, she was really trying to get something to Leonard the last few months, just to let him know that she, you know, she'd done all these huge projects and is now volunteering her time with EIS, but just to let him, she just wanted to get a note to him to let him know that her life was pretty chaotic when she was young, and she went into, you know, like engineering and project management, but basically that, what you were talking about earlier, that he had such a calm, unflappable view of the world that it helped her pull her, as a teenager, pull her, find ways to calm her life down, or to, you know, things were beyond her control, to get them under control, even, and how to approach life in a controlled way.
Yeah, very similar to me.
Be able to live long and prosper. Yeah. And again, it's just, I think he's just affected so many people on so many levels, but all those things. And we haven't really talked about the rest of his career. I tried to drop some things in there a little bit. A Woman Called Golda, where he played Golda Meir's husband, Ingrid Bergman's husband. That was the other Emmy nomination he had for Best Supporting Actor. But he did get out to do. Not only did he get comfortable in his skin as Spock, then he got to the point where he could do, you know, parodies and poke fun at it. Yeah. And, you know, we're familiar here lately, just the last few years, with the great video he does, the music video where he's
with
poking
Bruno
fun
Mars.
Himself, and the one, and the commercial with Zach Quinto where he neck pinches him at the end, for whatever car brand that is. Yeah, he really did come full circle.
Yeah.
And I just also have to say that no matter what people were doing, you know, dealers, fans, other actors, whatever, when he announced the retirement from the conventions a few years earlier, and we all went, oh, and then he came back. But then he announced it for real the second time in 2011. And I know he did the convention. He did the creation, had a Chicago convention after
this.
That's
right, yeah.
But the one that was really impactful was his last year at Vegas, after all the years of him, the last few years he and Bill had shared stage and, you know, whatever. And the last time he did that, like, the room was packed. I don't care who you were, what you did, where your pecking order in the franchise or in fandom or what your ticket price was, that room was packed because everyone knew it was his last time to be at Vegas. And it was amazing because instead of talking about Star Trek, which he'd done for ages, he did a slideshow of his life and started when he was a kid in Boston, came up, you know, a Jewish kid in Boston. His college, he was showing things from like kids and his college theater and some of the other roles he did. And he just went through his life. And of course, he got his photography into it. And it was just really memorable. And then I just remember being blown away even a couple years ago it was an Away Mission brand convention in Tampa, Florida, and the big thing was going to, and he'd already, he's retired from conventions, but he had recently, they came up with the idea of having him be on Skype, and this was a couple years ago, but nobody had thought of doing that yet. And for an hour, and I have some pictures of it, but he was on screen talking to the room. You know, they were like, is the tech going to work? Is this going to work out? And they had a laptop on a little pedestal over to the side. where you could go up, and it was just Skype with an inset in the corner, where the big screen showed him talking from his house. I think the house near Boston, I think. It wasn't in L.A. With the little inset of the person talking to him. And then the person at the laptop over at the side had a had an image, was seeing the same thing. And then him and on his, I think he had an iPad, he was seeing a big picture of the person talking to him with him as a little inset.
Sure, yeah.
So it was almost the same as having them here there live. In fact, one person, I remember a woman got up and said, "I'm so nervous, I feel like you really were here live." And everybody laughed. And then at one point, he was in a room. His grandson started off playing Bitter Dregs from Plato's Stepchildren. And here I, number one, and I'm just blowing away. I'm just going, oh my God, it's like he's making history again. This is incredible. I didn't know if this, how this would work. But that whole room was enthralled having him there in comfort, talking, spinning stories. People felt like they were connected with him, even though it was over a Skype line. They were in line. There was a long line. People were bringing their kids and holding them up in front of the, you know, the laptop so he could say hi to them. He could see them. He could see what they were wearing, what they looked like, what their hair looked like, if they were wearing a T-shirt. He would kid with them. They would kid back. It was just amazing. I was just, I was like, I can't believe this guy's done it again. And of course, even within a couple of years of that, he gave that up. And I think the Destination London last fall was the last time he did that, just because his COPD got so bad. He, it, after 10 or 15 minutes, it hurt him to talk. And we were, my friend Bonnie Moss, who works on his gallery shows, and I hope you can get her on sometime. She was a fan, but she'd work with him and his assistants over the years. She was trying to get to him to talk with us, even for 10 or 15 minutes for the Connor Rath. But the moment from that Skype that was amazing was, it was the last time he, I, you know, it's 2013 and I hear an original series story I'd never heard before, where he talks about the day, the Friday before they're going to shoot the Bitter Dregs moment in Plato's Stepchildren. The director pulls him aside and says, "Okay, Leonard, you're supposed to sing a song. Why don't you just go home, pick out a medievally, you know, madrigal type song, whatever you want to do. Whatever you're comfortable with, come in and do it Monday." Well, he didn't go home and find something historical. And he wrote Bitter Dregs, which I had never heard this before, much less how it happened. They came in Monday and shot it. Just blew me away. And here it's 2013, and I'm still hearing new stuff from this guy, which then the sad part is like how much is still – maybe that's written in a book somewhere. I don't know.
Maybe.
But I hadn't heard it.
But that's the thing, right? Like how much is still – in the heads of these people who were involved in the show that we haven't heard yet, and how much will be lost because we never have the chance.
I mean, that's kind of what drives me to do a lot of what I do, is to get as much of this recorded and down.
Yeah, same for me.
I mean, you know, it's like anybody. You don't remember what you did all through your life until maybe something sparks you to remember.
Right.
Anyway, those were, I mean, it was almost like up until the end, Leonard still had this hold on people, still was captivating, still was finding ways to enthrall people. Like I said, nobody got up and at the Vegas show, nobody got up and went, "Well, crap, I wanted to hear you talk about Star Trek. It's your last time." You know, he had everybody enthralled to see some of these images and watch him grow up in some of his other roles and his photography and what he'd done and his, you know, early childhood pictures and young man. And including, and I have to mention this because it was a joke years ago, and when Voyager did Captain Proton, and they had the Captain Proton flight pack. I did a double take when I first saw it because I hadn't seen it coming down the line like at the studio, and I had to get a slide. Back then, we didn't do frame grabs in the 90s. I had to get a slide, come back, and go research it. But the rocket pack, Bob Blackman and Jimmy Meese and the art department, everybody, the rocket pack on Captain Proton is the exact same thing that's on the front of the, like, on, off, fast, slow, up, down, little controls. It's the exact same thing as on the rocket packs from Zombies of the Stratosphere.
Oh,
that
really?
Leonard was famously, this ridiculous B-movie that he was in as an alien, you know, just swarthy-looking bad guy wearing these things. And, you know, there's no direct Leonard Nimoy or Spock connection to Captain Proton at all or any of those shows, but it was just another funky little way that they had a sense of humor and brought things full circle.
That's awesome.
Anyway, I want to make sure and include Zombies of the Stratosphere tonight. We're talking about Leonard.
Got it in there. All right, Larry. Well, we've been talking for over an hour, and I know we could talk for many more hours.
Yeah.
about Leonard Nimoy and what he meant to us in Star Trek and fandom. At this point, I think, you know, I'd like to invite everyone listening to continue talking to us about Leonard Nimoy in our listeners group on Facebook, which is the Babel Conference. Of course, mm-hmm. I'm in there. Larry is there as well.
I try to pop in when I can.
Yeah. And, you know, we will talk to you more about Leonard Nimoy and would love to hear your thoughts and find out what he meant to you, what the Spock character meant to you as well, your memories if you ever had a chance to meet him, and, you know, what his legacy is to you as well. So please come over to Facebook and share your thoughts with us there. Be sure to tag us. You know, you do the little at, do the name, so it tags us. You know, tag Larry and me in those so that we know that it was posted, because a lot of stuff gets posted, and we would love to continue conversation with you there. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the search field on Facebook, and that'll take you right over there, or click discussion on the menu bar on our website. Larry, if people want to, you know, send their thoughts to you, I know you've got a lot of different ways for people to get in touch with you. What's the best way for them to do that?
Well, the last couple of days, it seems like Twitter has been very hot and heavy and people sharing things, but that's just at Larry Nemechek. And then I haven't done a blog post at treklandblog.com yet, but this has been good tonight, because I keep refining some of my thoughts, but
you have time, you know, to talk. It's not a 5-minute sound bit, right?
Tonight. That's right. That was wonderful. Sky News in the UK and across Europe. I hopefully they said a few million people by the time that reran through the next day or two.
Yeah.
But it was only 5 minutes. We barely scratched the surface. But LarryNemechek.com and Larry Nemechek's Trekland on Facebook. And over at Enterprise in Space, I know we're talking about Nimoy and the impact that Spock had on people, and especially the science community, engineers and scientists, like my friend Mitzi, and so many people. That's good.
Great.
Trekland on Facebook and at Larry Nemechek Twitter. And it's going to be some fluid days. Everybody's still... I think I tweeted today and I said this, I was using a hashtag RIP Leonard Nimoy, and it's like, this is not, I said, I think this RIP, this hash RIP Leonard Nimoy is just going to be with us for a few days. We're just going to be overflowing and processing. Yeah.
I think so. I mean, I keep hearing from people who talk about how it, you know, it's still affecting them, and I think it'll take everyone a while to adjust and just express their thoughts and their feelings about it, because you kind of have to absorb it a little bit, think a little bit, and then it comes out bit by bit. I, of course, recorded Hyperchannel, so if anyone wants to hear some of my other thoughts, just me talking, that's Hyperchannel 74. I just turned on the mic and talked for about 10 minutes with no plan, and I've gotten some good feedback on that, which surprised me, because I was rambling. But I did that, and I did write a blog post, which I just put on my blog today, and you can find that there, cbrianjones.com. And, of course, the Babel Conference, which I mentioned, Twitter, cbrianjones, the letter C and Brian with a Y is how you can find me there. And, of course, other hosts on the network are going to be doing shows about Leonard Nimoy in the weeks to come, so tune into those, and you can hear their thoughts as well. So, Larry, thanks again for your time tonight. I know you've been racing everywhere, and you've got something else early in the morning tomorrow.
I guess I'm going to talk on a Boston radio station in the morning. And and you know, this coming year, this was the 50th anniversary of the second pilot, Where No Man's Gone Before. And, you know, it's an anniversary year, and we're a year away from the 50th. But my friend Lita Knight was saying, you need to jump on, you know, the topic of Spock and Leonard Nimoy is certainly something all through the convention year this year. At the conventions, big and small, and I've got several coming up, and certainly by Vegas time and Comic-Con, even at San Diego, we'll be talking about this, and I'll probably be talking about it in some of my presentations. So I look forward to seeing people down the convention circuit. Off top of my head, SciFiCon in Lake Charles, Louisiana, and Conduit in Salt Lake City, and of course SoonerCon back in Oklahoma City, and Comic-Con and Vegas, and those are the ones right off the top of my head. I'm going to do my first Skype talk to a big meetup of fans in Dublin, Ireland in another month. So,
and I have a feeling that in all these places, Leonard Nimoy is going to be one of the key topics.
Yes.
You're going to be talking about a lot.
I believe so. I believe so, yeah.
All right, everyone. Well, we're going to dispense with our usual closing to the Ready Room this week. So thanks for listening. Please share your thoughts with us. And we'll just leave by saying thank you, Leonard, for everything.
Yes, it's been a fascinating evening, Chris. Live long and prosper.
Others?